we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
All right, let's rock and roll. So episode 56 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. And can anybody on the podcast pronounce Tejile? Tejile!
Tejile!
So, Mark, I can't believe you get paid to do awesome stuff like that. I loved the video, by the way. That's brilliant.
It was a lot of fun.
You've seen it, Gabriel?
Yes, I have. It's about 7 years too late. No, because it's like I thought Tejile, Tejile, Tegili. I think, you know, that whenever you have a name that's kind of outside the storage box namespace, it's, you know, you kind of, I think it's important to have everybody know how to pronounce it. And I see nothing wrong with that. And it's tongue in cheek and it's fun. And I think, you know, the way it was done was, you know, traditionally Mark, but also very, very beneficial because everybody can have a laugh about it. But then guess what? Everybody's going to remember, and now they know how to say it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you guys remember Zygo? They were bought, I think, by Oracle a while ago.
Oh, yes.
Zygo?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to those guys saying, you know, well, first up, how do you pronounce the company name? And then second up, who decided on it? And apparently it was some kind of, I think they went to like a search engine or something that specialized in domain names that weren't taken, and they thought, that's cool.
Well, clownpenis.fart's not been taken either. You don't hear anybody using that one.
What's that?
Clownpenis.fart. It was a Saturday Night Live commercial, kind of during, which is a comedy show here in the U.S., but it was a show, I want to say it was probably 1996 or 97 when domain names were starting to get hot. And it was about a bank that was called clownpenis.fart because it was the last name left on the internet.
I'm taking it. I'm taking that one right now.
But that's the crux, isn't it? It is hard to find a domain name these days.
It is, yeah. All the four-letter ones are gone. Every combination of letters, I think, have been used.
But cloudpenis.fart, that's maybe a little bit too far at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody will get it when the time comes.
I could make a video on that.
Why don't you?
Yeah. Okay.
The thing is, though, we all know how to pronounce Tejile now, so job done. Well done. We do have a guest on the show this week. Lauren, you know what? I was going to say you've almost...
Wait a minute. Come on. You see, you halfway introduced her. What the hell is that?
I just appreciate the applause I get from Mark every time.
Oh, man.
He is the king of applause, and I am the worst podcaster.
Yeah, Gabriel, 10 and 2.
Yeah, what a cop-out.
There we go. It's on the steering wheel.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thanks for having me. Every time I have a few drinks, I like to DM Nigel and say, hey, let me back on your podcast. So,
no, honestly, we love having you on. It's cracking.
I love being on it.
What's with that, Lauren? I mean, if we were going to do that, we'd have to record every day?
You never know.
I'm thinking that's a bizarre thing. You have a few drinks, and what comes to your mind? Well, I want to go on In Tech We Trust. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that would normally come to mind when you've had a few drinks, is it? I hope it's not.
No, that is always. I listen to my podcasts while I'm drinking, and that's when I get it done.
It's
know?
The only way to get through some of them.
the loss of inhibition will allow you to say and speak what's truly on your mind.
That's deep. Hey, Gabriel, you're in the car today, aren't you?
I am. I'm actually driving past LAX right now.
Are we going to go for any live crashes on the podcast?
No, we'll try not to. I'm pretty good about one-handed driving or maybe even using the knee. I'm a seasoned driver talker.
Fair play. And you know what? There's hardly any background noise, so good job there.
Thanks to good German friends at Mercedes-Benz.
Ooh. Nice. Anyway, should we dive straight into the pure stuff? We've got like a kind of rough agenda, the usual tech news and then biz news. But you know what? I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn here, but the pure IPO just seems to have dominated the conversation for the last couple of weeks. And I don't know, bit of a damp squib, was it?
A bit of a damp squib.
Aren't squids all damp?
I just thought you started speaking Dutch.
No.
A damp squib?
Yeah, you don't know that.
No.
Oh, you need
Lauren,
to know.
Lauren, do you know that? Do you know damn squib?
Are you saying squib or squid?
Squib with a B for beta at the end.
Squib. Yeah. Yes.
No.
Don't ask me where it comes from. So anyway, was the Pure Storage IPO, was it a bit of a letdown?
From my perspective, I mean, I don't know what we were expecting exactly, and the market's been down anyway. So I know that they fell at least another, I think, 2% down to like 16.60 or something like that after kind of settling around $17. So I don't know. For me, even just a few of the articles I read said that they were third in the storage industry, you know, behind EMC and NetApp. And that was actually a little surprising to me. But I don't know. You guys are more storage oriented than I am. So
for me, they're a great marketing machine, right? And they've got a great product, but they are a one product company. And I think a lot of the competition is catching them up. A lot of the established three-letter vendors that are already in the big accounts and what have you that are out there, they've plugged all the holes in their portfolio. They've all got similar competing platforms. So I'm kind of not surprised. But what I do think, right, is that they're a big name, right? And they're a major player in a potentially massive market there. I mean, that's a $20 billion-plus market that they're competing for a decent share of, at least. So if they get their long-term game right, and you know what? I know that, you know, because the initial thing with the IPO didn't set the world on fire, shall we say, they're all coming out with the standard press releases saying, okay, not the end of the world, but you know what? We're in it for the long game here. And honestly, that's got to be the case, doesn't it? And if they can hold it together, and if they can, you know, get past the sprint and still have energy left for the marathon, there's a metaphor for you that's like abused to death. But if they can do that, they're in for a decent run, I think. I mean, it's still pretty positive in my opinion.
The concept of an IPO is not to, like, you know, double your money on the first day, right? It's an initial public offering, and it's a means to raise capital outside of the VC space, and it's a means for your investors to gain an exit and a return on their investment, right? And also to help bolster the company and move it forward. And if you look at the longer trend and what Pure is doing, their numbers look fairly good. You know, it's not like Google, right, where it's a household name and it has a massive market domination. And, you know, I'm listening to Peter Thiel's, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his last name, 0 to 1 book right now, and talking about going to market and bringing the product there and gaining monopolistic powers in how you address a space. You know, Pure Storage is not that, right? There's a lot of competition there. For them, it's successful because, you know, the people that invested their time and effort into building a product and getting it to market and getting that to that IPO space, which very few companies actually do, you have to look at it that way as it's a success.
Oh, totally.
Just because,
yeah.
Just because the stock didn't go to $25 today, and it's not like anybody who works at the company can sell it right now anyway, right?
Yeah,
true. That.
You have a 6-month period where you're locked from even, you know, selling share one. So 6 months from now.
Believe me, you're better off not having it spike up and then watch it come down horribly during the last month while you're on lockout.
Right. In there. Exactly.
From what I read, they haven't had a profitable year yet, although they are apparently doubling their revenues. And Gabe, you tell me, is that good numbers? I mean, obviously they are in it for the long haul, right? Because, well, you need to make a profit for people to make money, but.
Nimble's been IPO'd for what, a year and a half? They still haven't made a profit. Right. There's a lot of companies that go public that still don't make a profit for years. I mean, Twitter doesn't make any profit.
Sure. You know. Maybe now Facebook. With Jack Dorsey they will. But.
There's a lot of companies that are public that don't make any profit. But, you know, going to the stock market is now, I mean, here's the thing. Now with their books open with, you know, they have to play the game of increasing shareholder value. And that's the name of a game when you're a public company. And so, you know, it becomes a little tougher. You have to tighten the belt. You can't spend the way you used to. You have to focus on revenue and divergent revenue streams and a lot of different aspects of the business that weren't as critical when you were a startup and building the product and getting to that particular space. So your business model changes. There are certain aspects of it that change. And it'll be interesting to see over the next 6 months, and that's how I'm going to gauge this, and over the next 6 months to a year, whether it is a truly successful IPO. not based on the first day and the numbers and the volume that's there. I mean, last I looked, and it was probably like 9 o'clock this morning, they had over 10 million shares trading volume. That's good volume for an initial public offering for a stock, you know, for a company, let's put it that way, that let's say 98% of the United States investors have never heard of.
Hey, so Gabriel, I'm looking at the NASDAQ right now, and it's got share volume down as 18,798,000. So, and I'm assuming that is the number of shares that are trading out there.
Yeah, that's the number of shares that, that transversed hands over the course of the day.
There you go. And they're showing a market cap of $2.9 billion and current share price of $16.01. I heard actually, didn't 5 million shares get, or was it 10 million shares got traded in 5 minutes? Some crazy number.
Was when I was looking at the volume real time. I mean, you know, because I mean, I think Mark can attest to this. Anybody else who works in the storage business, it's still in pre-IPO mode. It's to our benefit, all of us.
Oh, yeah.
That Pure does well, right? Because nobody wants to see a storage company go to market and fall on its face yet again, because that just that does not bode well for the infrastructure industry, right? And so then, you know. You know, we're not the same type of unicorns to say the way like a Box is or an Uber or those
nobody has the Pure app on their phone.
Right, exactly. So it's definitely a much narrower space of market penetration. And the reality is, you know, EMC and HP and NetApp and all those guys that have, you know, competitive product offerings. I mean, they do hand over fist more business than all of us other smaller players combined. But this gives Pure the additional capital to continue to grow their market share and get into those marquee accounts. And now that they are a public company, it takes away a lot of the fear for certain customers that they're not going to be around. You know, are they going to get snatched up tomorrow? Right? Because there's always that FUD point around, oh, well, you know, you're going to be around 5 years from now. It's like, well, hey, you know, we just did an IPO and we raised all this money and, you know, our stock is doing this. You can gauge the company's health, and in turn, get that warm, fuzzy feeling for buying a product.
And, you know, if what you say their market cap was $2.9 billion?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah, that's pretty good market cap. I don't think anybody's complaining about that.
No, I'd agree. You know what, as well, and I can't find the link to it right now, so I'm a bit off the cuff here, but I read something, I think it was on CRN, that was saying of the 50 disruptive companies that they touted as potential IPOs for this year, I think that it said Pure was like one of five that had actually IPO'd. And it had like Uber and Dropbox and all those kind of household names that are out there. But hardly any of them have actually IPO'd. And it was kind of hinting that, you know what, the market's actually not great for IPOing at the moment either. So just set that as the backdrop for everything that's going on with a Pure IPO. And not the end of the world, I think we're saying, right?
Well, what's interesting is I think there's been a disconnect between what venture capitalists think the market can take and how they invest, right? So I think we might be seeing a little bit of a bad guess or the wrong direction by venture capitalists.
Pull back.
They've been piling into big companies, right? And so it's been, you know, their rationale has been that, you know, we'll invest in smaller number of companies and we'll throw more money in and we'll make these unicorns. But the market, the investment market, isn't so sure that the result of that unicorn trend, that unicorn growth, that unicorn feeding necessarily makes for a very good business down the road. You know, not a stable business. It gets used to running on fumes, right? And fumes is the wrong thing, but it gets used to running on venture capital and not money that's earned.
Well, it's also, you know, it's one of those things where the VCs need to diversify their offering, right? You know, they're going to, you know, green tech, which has been a failure for most of them. They'll go into infrastructure. They'll go into software as a service. They'll go into something that's, you know, Facebook-ish, where it's, you know, the amount of users and the expansion and growth of a, you know, an information base or big data. You know, there's a lot of different areas that they invest in. And, you know, for every dozen companies they invest in that turns out to be an Instagram, or, you know, for every one Instagram, there's probably 50, you know, companies that never even make it and they completely lose their money. So it's a, you know, there's a strategy involved there on who they invest in and how they, you know, what odds they place that those companies going to actual exit. Thank you, Common Sense Fairy. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, I'm not a VC yet, so.
High hopes, though.
If I ever get there, long shot, but.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to the VC industry if the unicorns that everybody's piled so much money into actually don't pan out that well for them.
That right? Yeah,
what if Snapchat totally falls on its ass and, you know, this thing that they valued at, what, like, ultra billions of dollars never ends up doing anything, never makes a profit, right? I mean, you've seen the leaked Snapchat numbers, where they made $3 million.
Yes.
Is that right? Putting
this massive valuation at it. I'm like, yeah, what if all of a sudden people decide to just, like, shit can those types of apps, or there's a change in focus and people move away from this kind of, like, you know, the Tinderization of their social lives.
We sort of take it for granted that the VC industry exists out here in Silicon Valley primarily, and that it will always continue, and that, you know, the sort of the smartest guys in the world or whatever control this money. But it's a more fragile industry than that. And they've had problems. I mean, it's hard actually to succeed at that business, like it's hard to succeed at any business. And I think the market's appetite overall for technology, you know, to your point, Gabriel, is not as big as it was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And, you know, let's face it, it's matured. It's like, do you still see people investing in automobiles anymore? Well, some, you know, you got, you know, Tesla or whatever. But otherwise, you know, the automobile industry does not have that same level of investment and activity that it used to. Technology's following, I think, a similar curve, right? So what's going to happen to venture capital if Snapchat and other companies, Uber and whoever else, you know, actually have problems? And you look at Uber and the kinds of problems they're having in Europe, in Asia, you know, and the amount of money that they have. What is it, $6 billion of investment?
Is that right?
I think is right. $6 billion of investment dollars, right? Is that company actually going to be able to make it or not? And of course, a lot of people that are in it, they'll just say, yeah. Well, they're hoping, you know, they're keeping their fingers crossed. You know, the kinds of valuations that the unicorns have, if that stuff falls apart, my guess is that the whole venture capital industry will have a major crisis.
You also see a lot of these people, I mean, I think a lot of lay people look at it and say, hey, there should be an exit three or 4 years or 5 years. Reality, a lot of these companies, you know, they should. It takes 10 years to build that kind of legit valuation.
True,
I think, yeah. And it's very rare. The Instagrams are rare, right?
Yes,
you know, those ones are. I mean, there's a whole lot of, like, Howard the Ducks out there, right?
You know? Wait, are you saying it's good or bad? I loved Howard the Duck.
But
Leah Thompson, are you kidding? Leah Thompson, I still got posters over somewhere.
I mean, it was a movie that had duck boobs in it. I mean, how could you not like that?
Hey, I've just looked this up on Crunchbase. Uber, $8.2 billion from 14 rounds and 62 investors.
Oh, it's more than I thought.
8.2?
Yeah. I just wrote a check for that.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Yeah. Oof.
All right, let's switch on to the normal tech news for the week then. So we've got, I think, three things looking at the list here. First up, Apple are apparently backing out of a multi-billion-dollar VMware ELA licensing deal. They seem to reckon that KVM is the future. Apparently, though, they're not like some Uber OpenStack house, so they're not like a Walmart or anybody. So who knows how they're going to provision and manage all that good stuff. Next item, HP announces yet another foray into the software-defined networking space. So adding to their existing deal that they've got with Cumulus Networks, they've now got something going with OpenSwitch community, not OpenVSwitch. The OpenSwitch community and another Linux-derived network operating system, all to augment their white box networking hardware, right? This is a good one, I think, actually. So technically, it's probably not tech news, but the DCIG buyer's guides are out again, and go pick one up as long as you don't mind apparently reading something that has zero actual testing behind it and is loaded with results that are massively biased towards the people who pay them the most, at least, right, according to a growing number of vendors out there. So Gavin McLaughlin from XIO had a really short piece out there. I'll put it in the podcast notes. Definitely worth a read, where he's absolutely slamming DCIG That's a good read. Last but not least, right? Don't know if anybody else cares. It's not enterprise tech, right? But Microsoft has rocked the world this week with the announcement of the Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Book. And I am not kidding you when I say this, right? I have honestly not been this excited about a product. So I'm interested in the Surface Book. I have not been this excited in a product since I was sat in Denmark on the couch with my wife many years ago watching Steve Jobs do the iPhone launch. I am stoked about the Surface.
Whoa!
I'm telling you.
Isn't it just a tablet?
Don't use the word just in the same sentence as Surface.
Does it have 3D texty touchy feely things?
Honestly, it looks the absolute bizzo. And for my needs, honestly.
If I kiss it, does it kiss me back?
It does more than that, Mark. Honestly, it's got this. No, I won't.
Does it have a USB port?
No, honestly, for my use cases, this is going to change my world. Anyway, can we hit first off, right, on this DCIG piece? Gabriel, you posted a link to Gavin's article in our Slack channel on the back end. I don't know if you or if anybody else wants to say anything about this, but I just love stories like this. It's a great little write-up by Gavin, short, to the point, and he's basically saying, I think, in fact, isn't his title something like DCIG is a shenanigans or a sham?
Well, I mean, my thoughts on it is, like, we all love the quote-unquote independent third-party analysis groups when they write favorable things or about us, or, you know, when we've paid them to write favorable things about us, but then somebody comes along and spends more and they write something about them.
That's not fair.
But that, I mean, that's indicative of all pay-for-play type of...
Yeah.
It's totally fair.
I mean, the reality is, it's like, all right, you can't get all butt hurt when things don't go your way if you don't pay to play. And so, you know, I mean, I look at the DCIG buyer's guide. I'm like, whoever looks at that and legitimately uses it a buyer's guide. But the second part of it is like, all right, you kind of get a flavor of where they were going based on how they wrote it up and who number one is or number two is. And, you know, in this particular industry, you know, we get really glommed on to these, you know, these position papers and analyst papers as if they're gospel. And the reality is, you know, I don't know how strongly they really push any one customer or company into the purchasing decision. Would I look at those? You know, when I was back on the opposite side, did I read those things? Yeah, I'd read those things, but I would take them with a large grain of salt because I kind of understood that these were not like independent, tested, validated. You know, we have a, it's not like an SPC thing, right? Where you can actually have some actual results to look at and I can validate it myself. It's marketecture.
And that's exactly one of Gavin's points as well, actually, that there's zero testing gone into any of this. A bit like, actually, some of the Gartner stuff, right? You know, the guys that are writing it have potentially, and I'm only saying potentially here, I don't know this situation with DCIG, but potentially haven't touched a storage array, or at least haven't touched one, you know, in anger, in production, for 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah, so add that grain of salt into it, plus the idea that, you know what, it's just the way things work in the world, right? You pay more, you get higher up the list, right? And if you understand that...
I'm going to say this in Jerome's defense, though. Jerome Wendt, the guy who runs DCIG, I mean, he is an old, not so old, but very experienced data center guy, right? And he's run a lot of products. He's been there in the trenches. He's done that. It's not like some guy that just stuck his hand up and said, well, here's an opportunity to make some money. Mm-hmm. He understands the environment somewhat. Now, to your point, you know, when's the last time he touched a piece of storage kit in anger? I love that, the way you say that. I'll have to ask you after the show, what do you mean in anger? I mean, that's like, didn't we have something earlier on in this show where you said something about a squib?
Yeah.
We had a damp squib and now touching things in anger.
No, I'm telling you, Mark, you obviously haven't touched a live storage array in a long time because they make you angry. Oh, my goodness.
What can I say?
There is no answer to that.
Yeah, I don't even pull disks out of them anymore. Where was I going with that? Anyway, so Jerome is, like anybody else out there, he's trying to make a living. And he's got a company and people that do this. And I don't think he's got idiots doing it. I think he's got, you know, people that have been around. So, you know, in his defense, it's not like that. Now, the criticism coming from a guy from XIO doesn't have much money. Their business isn't doing very well. We've talked about them a lot in the past. You know, that factors in also. right? If, and maybe Jerome says that, maybe he doesn't, but it would be pretty hard. I think, you know, it's got to be frustrating to be there and understand that there's no way in hell you're going to get a top rating from anybody just because of what the company's gone through and the prospect for the company. And is it going to exist in 2 years and all that stuff? Nobody's going to give you that nod.
And to be fair, every single story out there, there are at least two sides to it, right? Totally get that. You know what I used to like about the DCIG buyer's guides, right? And I did use them when I was working as a customer, is they seemed, at least in my opinion, to be aimed a lot more at the hands-on techie guy than some of the Gartner stuff is. And I'll be honest, when we were buying a flash array in the last company that I was an employee at, well, actually, I wasn't an employee, but I was working for them. Yeah, we put them all side by side, and we did. We didn't lean on them heavily. We POC'd kit and all that kind of stuff. But in the initial, you know, when you're initially stacking up 10 storage arrays against each other, you're not going to POC 10 arrays, are you? And you do need something that will help you whittle it down
I met with a customer. I met with a customer the other day, large customer, like Fortune 50, and Gartner. They actually had Gartner come in and talk to them in person about, this is the space we're investing in, or we're investigating right now. Can you give us the four recommendations that you would look at? Right. And that's, you know, that's not the norm for everybody. Not everybody's going to have Gartner come to their offices and have a discussion with them. But, you know, those guidelines do help kind of separate the pure storages from the pure storages from the Nimbus datas.
Oh, right? Brilliant.
So it's a starting point, right? And that's what it's supposed to be. You know, it's not like nobody's out there going, "I'm only going to buy the number one leader on the DCIG buying report." And, because if that's how they're making their decision, then they're doing their company a disservice by not doing their due diligence. It all fits in conjunction with everything you should be looking at, right? You take a lot of different disparate data points from different people, and then you do your own testing and trust and verify.
And then I saw that Storage Review kind of weighed in somewhere, right, where they were calling out DCIG. But Storage Review competes with DCIG in one way or another, right? That's just competitive shit. Maybe they're thinking they need a little more since they haven't been getting any of the VMware versus Nutanix stuff since that action died down. I don't know.
It's like going through 300 resumes, right? You're not going to interview 300 candidates. You're going to look for that one certification or degree or something. Get your pile down to 50 and then meet with those people, right? It's just like storage arrays. Like you said, you're not gonna POC, you know, every different storage array out there. That's just not possible. So there is some way you need to narrow it down. But, and just because, I mean, you might miss out maybe on a better storage array, but chances are, you know, you're probably gonna get a pretty good storage array if you start there and do your due diligence.
That's what it's about, isn't it? It's due diligence at the end of the day. You know what, Gabriel, you mentioned Nimbus Data. I am telling you now, right, if Nimbus Data came out number one, they would officially be a shenanigans, like they said.
That's a shenanigan, right? HP, get into the top. All right, you kind of see. There might be some legitimacy to that run. But, you know, if it was Nimbus Data, that we would know the fix was in.
I'm just saying, I worked with Jerome when I was at HP, and I guess we work with him at Ted Giles, so there you go.
Oh, yeah.
Did I say it right?
Tagili.
Hey, so on to the Apple pulling out of the VMware ELA deal, right? I don't necessarily want to talk about KVM and OpenStack and stuff like that, but does anybody else see a potential pattern here of excessively high VMware ELA licensing fees these days?
Apple said they're going to save $20 million by pulling out of that.
Well, okay, I mean, they'll save $20 million in licensing fees, but if they're going to deploy OpenStack and KVM, they're going to sink a fair portion of that into...
I don't even think anybody's even spoke about OpenStack. I just think it's been a change in hypervisor strategy. And if you think about it from an Apple standpoint, they... You know, if you're spending $12 million annually on your ELA with Microsoft or, you know, Microsoft or VMware or whoever it is, Oracle, that's a massive amount of money to spend on a hypervisor if you're not using the full stack of accompanying software that goes with it. And those tend to be like 3 to 5 year agreements to begin with. So, I mean, I would hope that they would look at that and reevaluate the standpoint. I mean, if I'm a CIO or CTO and I have a budget that's the size of Apple's from a technology standpoint, You're damn right. When one of those big agreements comes up, I'm going to sit down and evaluate the options that weren't there when I went into the agreement to begin with.
Yeah, but I think Nigel has a point, though. I mean, you don't have vCenter anymore. I mean, what do you have? And I mean, vCenter is obviously very low, you know, part of the features set available anymore. But it is an important feature as far as, you know, just having simple HA and DRS and all that good stuff. I don't know how exactly KVM can do that without the help of some other orchestration tool.
Yeah, but it's not like they're going to move off and on like tomorrow, right? That's going to be, I think what you're seeing is it's like, all right, you know what? We've paid for all these licenses. We have this stuff in place. We're going to slowly start to make the migration onto something else. And that's going to take 3 to 5 years in of itself. You know, I think it's more a strategic initiative to go open source on Apple's part than it is to just say cut off any one vendor or another. You know, they can do that and spend probably less money buying a la carte than they can maintaining a longstanding ELA that locks them into something for the next 3 or 5 years.
But didn't this start when VMware standardized on Google Music? That was a joke.
They'll no longer say.
Was a joke.
What's that about, Mark?
It was a joke.
I know that, but I don't get it. Is it?
It wasn't funny.
Oh. Yeah, it wasn't funny. Hey.
Those are the best. That's not good, Mark. It's your job on the podcast to throw in the wisecracks as well, isn't it? And when they're not funny,
yeah,
what have we got you here for? No, you know, I'm just kidding.
Thank you, yeah. Well, you know, I kind of think Apple is, you know, it's an iTunes. You know, so.
Oh, I get it. God, you know me.
I got it after you said it was a joke, but I did halfway think you were being serious there.
Well, what happened to me, right, is the whole recording went dead silent, and I thought, did I just all of a sudden get cut off? Is this an awkward moment of technology? But no, it actually was the damn thing I said.
Right. What else have we got?
I'm drinking new beer.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, did you make it yourself?
Yeah, my buddy Tony and I, we did a big batch of ale, of an IPA based on the 21st Amendment IPA, and I'm drinking it right now. It's pretty good.
So a good IPA today, but not a great IPO for Pure. That's not for you, right. Is it?
Yeah, exactly. It was a good IPA, but a bad IPO. Not a bad IPO. It's kind of lackluster.
No, that's true. That was a bit harsh of me.
Yeah.
Hey, on this HP software-defined networking piece, I don't have any clue of any of the details or anything like that, but we had a LinkedIn discussion going a little while back, a few weeks ago, after I think we'd had Greg Farrow on the show talking about NSX numbers, and had a quick look back at that LinkedIn discussion today, just before the show, actually. And interestingly, right, well, actually, before I say this, I should ask Lauren, as you are our resident networking guru, is what no pressure. Is what HP is doing here with things like Cumulus Networks and then this thing here with OpenSwitch, is this competing or is this intended to compete with the likes of NSX and ACI?
I mean, I imagine that's their goal.
At least broadly speaking, it is then, yeah?
Right, yes. I mean, I would put it in the same arena. If Gartner were going to analyze it, it might all be in the same quadrant, I guess.
Yeah, what God? Oh, dear.
Well, we were talking about analysts. So,
no, I get it. That's
continuing
fair.
Down that road. But you know what they're doing with OpenSwitch is kind of first of all, I don't know why it's open because they're still requiring HP switches right now. I mean, they say that, you know, there's been discussion of allowing other switches, but right now it's all HP switches.
Right.
I mean, really, if they're trying to attack Cisco ACI with that, that's kind of a bad maneuver, right? At least currently, right? You know, apparently Arista has said that they're going to contribute to this effort, but again, we're not seeing actually anything from Arista. They're saying it's all open, but actually HP owns, you know, all of the domain space, the GitHub site, the whatever that's attached to OpenSwitch.
So it's like intended to be a big community thing with a bunch of different vendors contributing towards it, I suppose, all potentially with Cisco in the crosshairs there.
Yes, that's what I imagine it to be. But right now, it's actually a Cisco program or project leader doing it all.
HP.
Yeah, I'm sorry, HP. Thanks for the correct. So it's really all HP, and I'm not sure what's open about it. I mean, they're basically forking off of like Quagga and Open vSwitch, so there's not a whole lot of new IP out there, but I'm not exactly sure what they're saying as far as it being open, because it's technically no more open than Cisco ACI is.
Okay, so coming back to what I was saying about the LinkedIn group there, right? So we talked about NSX and ACI deployment in the real world, right? And we had one or two people chime in and say, well, we actually are deploying in the real world and we've got customers doing this and that and whatever. But the overall numbers seem to be, right, and don't take these as gospel, but I think they are fairly official. NSX, 700 paying customers, about 150 real world deployments. ACI, about 1,000 paying customers, again, about 150 deployments in the real world. So we're talking in total, right? And I know this is probably the very thin edge of the wedge here, but we're talking around about 300 real world deployments of the two leading software defined networking solutions out there. So HP is coming in with this kind of, it seemed to me, right? I don't know. I didn't know whether to consider their approach as like either half-hearted because they've got the OpenSwitch thing. They've already got the Cumulus Networks agreement going. They've got this kind of hodgepodge almost of networking hardware as well. Or have they got this really broad and diverse portfolio, and are they spreading their bets? And are they, you know, poised to be the Cisco of the software-defined networking world? I don't know.
If you pulled 10 people who worked in the networking industry to ask them about who's leading the future of software-defined networking, I don't know if anyone would actually say the words HP. Right? I look at software, and maybe it's just, you know, there's 300, you know, legitimate deployments of SDN, because that's, you know, that's the kind of companies that can actually benefit from SDN in its truest sense. You know, it's
what,
not
so
like
saying the market's really small then?
I think the market is very defined and nascent.
Oh.
And that everybody's hedging their bets that it's going to be the future of something bigger. And that this is the way, the first wave of introduction is into going into the type of customer space where a software-defined networking play actually proves out value associated with the costs and time and effort associated with a software-defined X.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And we are kind of hedging our bets that it's the future. And, you know, hopefully, for me, it's definitely the future, since that's what gives me a paycheck. But, you know, I will point out, you know, we have 150 production customers in just over a year. So if you, you know, look at the way it's moving, which is not necessarily linear, it could get very big very quickly.
And those 150 paying customers could very well be like the Symantecs in the world, who are spending millions of dollars on something like ACI.
Right.
It's not going to be, you know, Bob's Big Boy Burgers.
No.
That's going to have, you know, 20 ESX, you know, 20 compute hosts and, you know, 150 ports. It is a type
sure
of customer.
I'm not sure what kind of server Big Boy has, but.
You get a big one. It comes with fries and a shake.
It's thick.
They do have good shakes. I will say that for Bob's Big Boy. And awesome hash browns. If you ever get a chance to go to Bob's Big Boy, breakfast is where it's at. But, it's just, you know, it's one of those spaces that is going to continue to grow. We see that with a lot of different companies out there, especially large ones that with diversified portfolios. They need to be continually looking for that next thing is going to elongate their franchise. And software-defined networking in the Bob's Big Boy space is really not that hot, but perhaps in the you know, the large telcos and the SPs and certain customers of that nature, it's definitely the future. So,
yeah, I mean, I would also say, I mean, the whole open, you know, idea, and you guys have talked about this sort of thing before, not just SDN, but SD anything. Are people likely to buy a totally open environment, like smaller customers? Let's say, you know, not small, but, you know, not your huge enterprises, right? Or do they want something that's supported, that scale's been tested on, that they can easily get answers to, software that's built for the hardware? You know, I think that comes into play as well.
Totally agree with that.
My mind is just so in the gutter after all that.
It's that was terrible. That was great.
I'd like to think you guys save these conversations just for me.
We do.
Oh boy. Yeah. Yeah. Apparently. Who knew that this was coming up?
What to edit out and what to leave in. Be a good day tomorrow. Shall we wrap the show up with some biz news then? So we've got a few things on the business agenda. Well, we already talked about the Pure IPO. Oh, next one. Here we go. The story that seems to refuse to go away. Right, there's yet more talk that Elliott are pressuring EMC to split the Federation again, and that other favourite of everybody's, should EMC and HP merge, acquire? Oh, hey, should they make love? Whatever, right? There's a
or should they just have breakfast at Mark's Big Boy with
Bob's Big Boy
and elongated software-defined stuff?
Oh, and give it a shake at the same time.
Don't even edit this, Nigel. Just publish tonight.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, it's a real-time show. I'm so burned out on Elliot right now. Just because it's like, it's just, I don't know. I can't even begin to fathom. If you want my opinion, break Pivotal out because they seem to be giving the finger to EMC and VMware anyway, and be done with it.
Goes from worse to worse.
I mean, the articles make a good point, though. I mean, EMC and VMware are constantly having
they're the same
competing
company.
Tools. Well, they're the same company with competing tools. And I mean, I get that they have competing tools because, you know, if you don't have a VMware environment, well, then you can put Scale.io or whatever the hell, you know, in your other environment. And Apple can use Scale.io now if they want, you know, whatever.
What do you mean competing tools, though? Are you talking about vSAN?
vSAN, I mean, they've had several. And, of course, what was it? Syncplicity was one with whatever kind of Dropbox VMware was using.
That was the only customer that Syncplicity has was EMC.
That's
I don't know
great,
why anybody
Nigel.
Bought that.
That's great, Nigel. Invite a guest on and then challenge her authority. There you go.
No, I like
it's all right. She drinks enough. She'll want to come back on.
That's right.
I can't believe that.
You can send her some of that Vegemite beer or whatever the heck you guys drink over there in the UK.
No, but you know what it is, right? So, and I've kind of thought that vSAN is a quite a strong competitor to some of the EMC product portfolio, and especially the more recent releases are pretty good. But you know what? The more and more people I speak to just say, you know what? It's still quite deficient, and it's not a real competitor, certainly to the enterprise level stuff. And they're saying, yeah, it's suited for like small customers, small offices, stuff like that. Get any bigger than that, and it starts to break. I mean, it doesn't start to break
it's
as
like,
in those days,
like,
but
it's like all the open source storage place, you know, plays you can, you know, run with. I mean, I was in a friend of mine's tech shop, a company I used to work for the other day, just talking. And I was like, yeah, we want to use Open FreeNAS for our production environment. I'm like, are you on LSD? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to put any of your, you're going to trust any of your business on this thing, or, you know, even some of the pay for play software defined network and storage stuff, or software defined storage plays. I'm like, yeah, you know, you're going to do that in your dev test instances or something that you're playing around with, but it's not, you know, there's certain customers where, yeah, it's good enough and it meets their needs. And I think vSAN is a good product and it has a lot of opportunity. And, you know, VMware's obviously invested a lot of time and money and effort into it. But it's not going to be running, you know, an insurance company or a hospital.
Yeah.
At least not yet, right? It's, you know, use the tools that are in your bag or at your disposal for the proper thing, you know. And
if you want to use file on it, you've got to use, well, you don't have to, but the solution, throw some NextCenter into the mix. That says it all.
Right.
If it is a smaller company, I mean, do they even have the money to have all? I mean, vSAN can cost you just as much as, you know, a little storage appliance. So,
I will not challenge your authority on that one, Lauren.
Thank you, Nigel.
You know what, though, this whole Elliott thing, right? I'm starting to come around to the opinion that they're just not going to shut up about it, are they? If they don't get their way, they've got the sniff of some money here for them and for the other shareholders. And until they get their own way, they are just going to beat on and on and on about it.
keeps them in the news.
Yeah.
Do they have recourse? I mean, if EMC says no, we're going to keep,
They just dump the stock. I mean, they own what, 1% of it or whatever it is. Right. It's like they can impact the share price. They can do a lot of things. I mean, they have voting rights on the board or they have voting rights based on their share allotment. I mean, there's a lot of different little areas that they can engage in. It's just a matter of how much impact they have. You know, it's like how many, I'm still waiting for Joe Tucci to retire. I mean, that rumor has been around for like 10,000 years. Apparently.
I don't think Elliot will go away until either they get their way or until Joe goes. And then when Joe goes, it's a free for all. And then they'll get their own way. It's just my two pennies worth.
I mean, and it's to their benefit to elongate this, and obviously the longer they hold the stock, they don't want to keep it for 10 years, but they definitely want to keep it more than 6 months, based on the capital gain structure and taking long profit versus a short. And, those guys are, I guess that they're like financial wizards because they're billionaires and stuff. So, I kind of have to put a little bit of faith and effort into what they've done. This is not the first time they've done this. I mean, they had investments in Emulex and QLogic and Broadcom and Brocade and, EMC and NetApp. I mean, you look at their track record, they've done a lot of these things to enact change. They have a pretty good track record, if I remember correctly.
But they haven't messed with anybody like Tucci.
No, and he is holding his ground like a stalwart.
I just picture him sitting on a trident and a laser rifle or something. So, come on, bro. Come at me, bro.
Yeah, I think Tucci probably is actually enjoying this by now. God, every time I say something.
Crickets.
The hell?
I recommend you drink a different beer next time, Mark. This one is...
Oh, man, I'm going to drink my pumpkin beer next week.
It's all hopped up.
No, I can see that with Joe because, he's achieved so much in EMC and the Federation and all that. He's coming towards the end of his career retirement. He's made it, Well, what does he care at the end of the day, right? It's not like he's some young guy fighting for his own startup that he's, it'd be a bit harsh of me to say he's not bled for the company. I'm absolutely certain that he has actually. But what does he care anymore?
Well, he cares a great deal. He put this whole thing together. He doesn't want to see it taken apart by a bunch of twerps.
No, sorry, that's what I mean. What does he care? As in, he doesn't care of the repercussions of a fallout with Elliot and any future impact that'll have on his career and stuff like that. He just cares about EMC. That's all he cares about, and that's a great position to be in my books.
Yep.
Anyway, peeps, we've got one last story that I want us to quickly touch on just in case anybody thinks it's an awesome story. So IBM to buy CleverSafe, to add to their hybrid cloud portfolio. So
smart.
Yeah.
Good move, really good move.
Okay, so the terms of the deal are undisclosed, which I think normally means not very much. I could be wrong, A couple of articles I've read have said they do have over 350 related patents, which is never a bad thing.
Yeah. No, but also if you look at the direction that IBM is going and who they've picked up recently, so they picked up Blue Box. They're making a strong, very strong push into managed cloud, managed OpenStack, hybrid cloud, services-oriented type stuff for that kind of next-generation data center feel. CleverSafe falls into that. I mean, CleverSafe, and I've engaged with them in the past and had relationships, when I was at Cisco and some of these other companies I've worked in. They have a very good, solid product, and it's one of those things where it's like the initial buy point is like 500 terabytes to a petabyte. So they go after these very large implementations, and if you're going to be powering, let's say you're a cable service provider and you have 5 million customers and all of them need an email system, everybody gets 100 gigabytes or whatever it is for their email or, whatever it is, right? Those kind of large archival unstructured data solutions require some pretty interesting software technologies. And to make it work economically, you have to go with community off-the-shelf hardware and some kind of software component that has a robust viability. That's why you bring something like a CleverSafe or a Scality or SwiftStack into the mix.
So CleverSafe had, I think, in the area over $100 million of investment. And it was going to be tough for them to to recoup that in a hurry. Whereas being part of IBM with a global sales force that IBM has, you know, that business, I think, can accelerate very quickly. I like that deal. I think CleverSafe's had good stuff, you know, to back up what Gabriel said. And I think it's going to be successful for IBM. You know, IBM can still screw up. Can still screw it up. Any large company can screw up any acquisition.
Yeah, but for the price of this, it's not like it's autonomy.
Oh, no, this is no autonomy. No.
You know what? Are IBM gearing up here in like the hybrid cloud space for an all-out war with Microsoft? You know, are they going to?
Yeah, they'll take on that Store Simple product.
Nice.
Yeah, no, it does seem like every other article I read has IBM doing something cloud related.
No, it's the natural transition for IBM is, you know, they've moved away. The only hardware they have anymore, the only business machines they have anymore, like Z series, and you know, I would expect them to shop their storage portfolio here in the next 12-24 months away as well. You know, they got out of PC, they got out of server, they got out of peripherals, all these other things, and now they have this massive services industry arm and integration arm that is just, you know, it's, they make money hand over fist with that. And they're starting, you know, they've done this, you know, they've gone through the layoff period and then the shrinking portions. And, you know, it's been interesting to see their profitability numbers continue to decline, what, for 12 straight quarters. But I think that they're in this for the long haul. They're not looking at this from a 1 to 2 year viability standpoint. It's they're more at the 5 to 10 year in the direction of what their customer base is looking to go at, and they're making those adjustments now.
Well, there is that. I'm glad you reminded us of that, Gabriel, that IBM has actually been, you know, the ship with the hole in the hull, you know, sinking. So who knows?
Yeah. I think all the large 100,000 plus companies have had that kind of a challenge as of late.
They have, absolutely.
Yep.
I think it's going to be, I mean, cloud, though it's the future, it's a tough gig, right? I mean, even Rackspace just started selling AWS and Azure, right? So it's kind of, I don't know, is it going to be too little too late?
I think Rackspace's issue was, though, that their pockets weren't deep enough to compete with the kind of scale of Amazon and Microsoft. And I'm not saying that IBM's cloud services do, but they have a kind of, almost like Microsoft, in my opinion, right, they have a kind of almost unique selling point into enterprises that Amazon Web Services does not have, right? IBM are a trusted partner with most of the big enterprises out there, right? And we know that Microsoft Azure is making inroads into enterprises. Maybe, I don't know, maybe IBM and its burgeoning cloud portfolio here is going to be more of a competitor in the enterprise than Amazon Web Services is.
Could be interesting.
They can definitely position themselves to take business from Amazon for those who want to do an on-premises hybrid approach.
Marvelous.
Can we just get rid of on-prem, on-premises, all this? Can we just do on-site?
Wouldn't it be just so much easier?
Jesus Christ. I mean, it just seems like so stupid. I'm like, everybody wants to fight that battle. I'm like, on-site. So much simpler to spell and say.
You could just say
on-site. On-site?
I'm always nervous that I say on premise instead of on premises, and then you get flamed for it. It's like,
you could just say on prem,
at your house.
Yeah,
private, public.
There you go, as well. Yeah. Anybody got anything else then? Because we are running towards the hour.
Thank God.
Oh,
this is a tough one.
Well, you know what? On that note, Lauren, it's been, as usual, magic to have you on the show. Go on, Gabriel, tap the steering wheel there in appreciation.
Magic!
Can we get a toot of the horn, Gabriel? Oh, there we go. That's what I'm talking about.
So where are you now? Anybody by Long Beach? Have you gotten Long Beach yet?
Good. Yes, I'm passing the vast swath of the to my right is the wonderful gas farm that is the there's like this old, I have no idea what the hell it is. There's like these bunkers.
I've been called that before, gas farm.
Yeah. There's these bunkers that hold fuel or something, or like missiles, or I don't know what it is. But I've driven past it a million times. I have no idea what it is. But these weird bunkers on the side of the 405. But yes, I am finally in Long Beach after. Yeah, it's taken me a full hour to go, like, you know, 25 miles. Thank you, LA traffic.
A well-spent hour, though.
Good way to, like, you know, fight your way through traffic, talk on a podcast.
And you didn't crash either.
Not yet.
Yeah, some people listen to podcasts while they're commuting. Gabriel talks on them.
Yeah, well done. Anyway, no, thanks again, Lauren. Mark, thank Gabriel, you. As always, marvelous. Cheers. Thanks, everybody, for listening as well. And let me give a shout-out to a discussion we've got going on the LinkedIn group as well. Interesting discussion that's getting quite a few comments on who potentially pays for Docker in the enterprise.
Nobody.
Ooh, I knew you were going to say that, Gabriel. But it's an interesting discussion.
They gave it all the best parts away.